You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Back when HIV was first diagnosed in San Francisco, it hit the gay male population hard. Since that time, the virus has spread to more diverse communities. Nana Khanna is the executive director for Positive Women's Network, which represents more than 2,500 HIV-positive women. In 2010, she was appointed to President Obama's Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. Khanna herself was diagnosed with HIV in 2002, as she told KALW's Ben Trefney.
You know, when I was diagnosed, it was in November of 2002, and one of the reasons it was so shocking and surprising was because I had actually tried to get tested twice before and had been told both times that I didn't need a test. And what I didn't know at the time, but kind of, you know, learned later through meeting other women living with HIV, is that this is really not an uncommon situation for women to face, that, you know, a lot of times women are discouraged from testing or not seen as being at risk. And so frequently are tested, you know, late into their diagnosis or once they get sick or because they're pregnant or, you know, kind of going through the healthcare system for some other reason and getting lab tests done.
In 2002, did you see this as something that was going to be beatable?
I saw it as something that it was definitely life-changing. It was totally transformative. I had no idea what to do with this information. It was the last thing I expected to hear. I couldn't figure out how to fit it into my life, so I sort of compartmentalized it and went about the rest of my life. So I really didn't deal with it for the first couple of years after my diagnosis. I was busy doing other things.
Did your body degrade? I mean, did you see symptoms?
Not really. I was pretty healthy. I was always pretty healthy, but I was working really hard on the election in 2004.
Your body might have degraded just from that.
Yeah,
because you weren't sleeping.
Yeah, I definitely saw some things going on with my body that were, you know, that I kind of just attributed mostly to stress and probably compromised immune function. I wasn't motivated to go to the doctor right away because of this whole set of concerns that I had about health insurance access and being excluded and potential employment restrictions or things like that. But I was motivated because my boyfriend at the time and I saw this information come out about the fact that I might actually be able to be a less risky partner. And, you know, so that was more motivating to me at the time. And it was certainly motivating as part of my relationship. And I think it's important to understand that a lot of times people make decisions about medical care in the context of our families, our communities, our relationships.
So when HIV began to strike American communities, it began primarily in white, middle-class, gay communities. Who gets HIV now? Like, how has that changed?
The demographics of the epidemic have changed a lot. It has become increasingly racialized, increasingly feminized, increasingly impoverished. So now we see that a disproportionate number of infections are happening among young men who have sex with men of color, and also among women of color, and across, you know, sort of both sets of those populations, disproportionately in communities that are poor and have less access to resources and less access to information.
Why is it in more marginalized communities?
If you just think about the way that HIV is transmitted, so HIV is, it's much less likely that HIV is going to be transmitted if your viral load is suppressed, okay? It's basically not something that you're going to pass on to your
sexual partner.
And when
you say viral load, do you mean that
the amount of HIV in your bloodstream.
Okay.
The amount of HIV virus that shows up in your bloodstream, in your seminal fluids, in your vaginal fluids, in breast milk. Those are the four fluids that transmit HIV. So when I say viral load is suppressed, I basically mean that it's at levels where it's not detectable in most of those fluids. So the likelihood that you can transmit it is very low. So once you get to a community where the viral load is higher because there's less access to healthcare, because there's less frequent testing, or because there are restrictions on federally funded and publicly funded programs so that you don't face with private health insurance. So, for example, a private health insurance company might give you a 60-day or a 90-day supply of your medication. a state-funded program might require you to get a 30-day supply at a time and will only fill it, you know, 2 days before it's going to expire. So if you can't make it to the pharmacy at that time, or you're out of town, or your grandmother's sick and you need to help her and you just couldn't go to the pharmacy, or your kid is sick or you need to take them to school, you're more likely to miss your doses and less likely to have a suppressed viral load. So, you know, there are many ways in which people who are facing more barriers to healthcare and to access and less financial security are more at risk for having an unsuppressed viral load.
That is Nana Khanna. She is executive director of the Positive Women's Network, a national membership body of HIV-positive women grounded in gender equity and human rights. So you're on the President's Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS and have been since 2010. How do you see this president in dealing with this? Do you think that he's been doing things that you've liked, and what would you like to see him do?
So President Obama has taken some major steps forward in our in addressing the domestic HIV epidemic. For the first time ever, we have a U.S. national HIV/AIDS strategy, which was released in July of 2010, which is our first ever coordinated domestic plan to address the epidemic. You know, this is almost 30 years into the epidemic that we had the first ever coordinated domestic plan released. Although the U.S. has required other countries to have plans in order to get our funding for years. You know, that was another major step forward by the president. And then, of course, the Affordable Care Act, you know, can't be taken out of this equation. It has huge implications for people living with HIV. It has huge implications for people at risk for HIV by including specific guidelines around regular HIV screening and making sure that those will be reimbursable, you know, so that insurance companies are required to cover that. So these are major steps forward in terms of enhancing the health of people living with and at risk for HIV.
What should people know about HIV today?
HIV is not a death sentence anymore. It's something that you can live with, and it's something that you can live not just survive with, but live a long, healthy, dignified, high-quality life.
You seem awfully healthy.
I'm pretty healthy. And that means that there are things that need to change. Stigma is a huge problem. It is, you know, possibly even a bigger problem than it was in the early days of the epidemic. And there have been national surveys that show that the numbers of people in the U.S. who are uncomfortable with an HIV-positive person caring for their child or preparing food for them are higher today than they were in the 90s. And that's really a huge problem. It shows a lack of basic information, and it reflects, I think, very poorly on our system of sex education and health education that we have in this country.